Genetic testing is all the rage in psychiatry, but the test that might work best is the one that no one's talking about.
Welcome to the Carlyle Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlyle Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue.
Last month, we covered a new randomized controlled trial of pharmacogenetic testing in depression. The study failed to find any meaningful difference with the genetic test, even in patients who had not responded to one or more antidepressant trials. We've covered a lot of these studies in the journal, and all of them have a similar fate. The better the design of the study, the more likely it is to fail. Among the casualties are GeneSight's AssureRx, NeuroID Genetics, Neuropharmacogen, and, in last month's trial, Genomine's GeneSept.
So why do we keep covering these disappointments? Well, for one thing, the genetic testing industry keeps promoting these trials as successes, with glossy brochures that misrepresent the outcomes. In each of these trials, the test failed on the primary outcome, but it did make a small difference on some of the secondary outcomes. This is not unusual in statistical research, like the type we do in psychiatry. Every time you measure something in a study, it's like rolling the dice, and there's a 1 in 20 chance that you might get a positive result by luck alone.
That's why secondary outcomes are not meant to inform practice. They are meant to inform future research, to test whether they are solid, repeatable results are just random statistical noise. That hasn't been done with genetic testing, but let's suppose that it has and these secondary outcomes are really valid. Still, they are not that impressive even if they were valid. In the case of GeneSight, you'd need to test 19 patients to bring one to remission based on their secondary outcomes.
But in fairness, sometimes the tests don't even change the treatment, either because the results are normal or the patient isn't taking any medications that are affected by the test. So one thing you'll hear emphasized at industry-sponsored talks on genetic testing is that the tests make a big difference when the test results suggest that the patient's medications are out of sync with their genes. Sounds intuitive. Who could argue with that?
But even that's not the slam dunk that it sounds like. In the large GeneSight study, you'd need to test 13 patients to bring one to remission after excluding all the patients whose testing didn't change their actual direction of treatment.
But the news is not all bad. In recent issues, we focused on specific genetic tests that can make a difference when your patient is taking certain medications, even if the larger genetic panels come up short. And there is one genetic panel that has a positive trial, and it involves an entirely different kind of gene.
Most genetic tests look at a combination of pharmacodynamic genes, these are the ones that shape the brain's response to medications, and pharmacokinetic genes, specifically the genes for the CYP enzymes that metabolize many psychiatric medications. So the pharmacokinetic genes influence whether the patient is going to reach an unusually high or low level of the drug in their body. To put it another way, pharmacodynamic genes purport to influence medication selection, whether the patient will respond, say, to a tricyclic or an SSRI, while pharmacokinetic genes influence medication dosing, whether they're going to need an unusually high or low dose to achieve an adequate serum level. But the genetic test we're going to focus on today, the one with the positive study, didn't look at any of those. It looked at a gene that codes for P-glycoprotein transporter. This is the transporter that acts like a bouncer at the blood-brain barrier, kicking unwanted chemicals out of the CNS. The problem is, it also kicks some psychiatric medications out of the CNS, and when it does, the patient is going to need a high dose to have a chance at responding to the drug. The genetic test in this study looked at two genes that code for the P-glycoprotein transporter. They are ABCB1 and ABCC1, We'll call them ABC genes for short. In some patients, these genes upregulate the transporter, causing it to kick out drugs more aggressively, so the patient requires higher doses. In others, the transporter is downregulated, so the lower doses are required to achieve adequate levels in the CNS. But most people have average genes and just need average doses. Now that you have an idea of what PEDE glycoprotein does, let's look at the actual study.
The study was conducted by Ajit Singh, an Australian psychiatrist who helped start the company that sells this genetic test. That company is CNS Dose, and the specific test they use is called the AmpliChip test. The full CNS Dose panel includes a few other genetic tests, like the popular CYP genes 2D6 and 2C19, as well as UGT1A1, which metabolizes desvenlafaxine. But Dr. Singh's study only looked at the PEDE glycoprotein genes. Like most genetic studies, it was industry-sponsored, but otherwise it checks all the right boxes on study design. It was a randomized trial where half the patients had gene-guided dosing and the other half had treatment as usual. It was double-blind, meaning that the patients and raters didn't know who got the test. That's important because we've noticed a trend where unblinded studies come up positive. But when they are repeated with a blinded design, the results don't look so good, suggesting that simply ordering the test has a powerful placebo effect for the patient.
The study involved 148 patients with major depression who were treated for 3 months. And unlike a lot of genetic trials, they didn't limit the sample to patients who had recently failed an antidepressant. That's a strength in this case, because patients who have failed their first trial are more likely to have genetic abnormalities, making it easier to come up with positive results with that kind of enriched sample. Another difference with Dr. Singh's study is that the genetic test was only used to inform dosing, not medication selection. The doctors were free to use any antidepressant they wanted, and the test told them whether they were likely to need a low, medium, or really high dose. That's also a mark in the study's favor, because some antidepressants aren't affected by the PEDE glycoprotein transporter at all. And if he had just limited the study to the antidepressants that are, it would have made the test look more powerful than it is in the real world. But despite all these hurdles, the results were still positive.
Just how positive? The numbers here are pretty big. Those who got the gene-guided test were nearly 3 times more likely to remit from depression, 72% versus 28%. Put another way, for every 3 patients you tested, 1 would achieve remission by virtue of having the genetic test.
So what's the catch? Well, this is only one study, and we'd like to see it replicated preferably by a group with no stake in the product. There is a second study of CNS Dose, but it had a very different design. Still, it's worth reviewing because it tells us a little more about how this test influences drug dosing. This study from 2017 followed 119 patients with depression as they started treatment with desvenlafaxine, brand name Prestiq. This antidepressant is one whose dosing is likely to be affected by 2 genes in the CNS dose panel. The UGT1A1 metabolizes desvenlafaxine in the liver, and the PEDE glycoprotein gene kicks desvenlafaxine out of the brain. In this open-label study, the doctors were encouraged to raise desvenlafaxine's dose up to 200 milligrams a day based on the patient's response, but to raise it no faster than by 50 milligrams every 2 weeks to avoid side effects. At the end of the study, 80% of the patients had remitted, which is a pretty high number. They then ran the CNS dose test on those who remitted to see what dose the panel would have recommended for each of these patients if it had been done from the start, and whether that dose aligned with the dose that the patient ended up on, the one that worked for them. 90% of the time, the doses aligned. These results are very informative, even if you don't use the CNS dose test, because the PDR states that there is no evidence that desvenlafaxine works any better once you get beyond the 50 milligram a day dose. In this study, the CNS dose genetic tests suggested that higher doses, at or above 150 milligrams a day, were needed in 15% of patients. The test suggested that low doses, at or below 50 milligrams a day, were adequate in 20% of patients. And for the rest, the recommended dose was between 50 and 100 milligrams a day. The bottom line, if you use desvenlafaxine, you might bring more patients to remission if you march it up toward 150 or 200 milligrams a day, as about 15% of your patients are likely to need a higher dose.
And here's a paradox. Clinicians who use popular genetic tests like GeneSight often find that desvenlafaxine is the only antidepressant that almost never runs into conflict with the test results. And yet it's one of the antidepressants whose dosing is most impacted by the P-glycoprotein gene, which isn't included in most genetic panels.
So, if you're going to order a genetic panel, CNS dose is the only one we know of that can claim positive results in a well-designed clinical study. But those results only inform antidepressant dosing, not selection. And if you don't order this genetic test, you might still get there by dosing a little higher than usual in patients who don't respond. But you're not going to know who really needs a higher dose in advance. That clinical dilemma is what inspired Dr. Singh to embark on this journey. Early in his career, he saw a patient with severe depression who had not responded to any treatments except venlafaxine. The problem was, he only partially responded to this medicine at a dose of 225 milligrams a day. Dr. Singh decided to go beyond the max dose, gradually raising venlafaxine to 450 milligrams a day, at which point the patient fully recovered. The treatment was a success, but Dr. Singh knew that he could have saved this patient from a lot of pain, including, in this case, the loss of his job, his marriage, and a suicide attempt, if he had found this strategy much earlier. This got him interested in identifying patients with metabolic differences ahead of time through genetic testing.
Dr. Singh has developed a new version of the test, which includes more genes, 16 in total, called Amplis Evo. The test is available for $195 Australian through Base Pair Genomics.
The P-glycoprotein transporter is not as well studied as the CYP enzymes in the liver, so we're not always sure which antidepressants are affected by it and by how much. But many antidepressants do seem to pass through its grip in one way or another, as do some antipsychotics, mainly risperidone and paliperidone. Besides genetic variations, drug interactions can also speed up or slow down this transporter, so understanding how to adjust the dosing can get complicated pretty quickly. But let's end on a simple note. We counted four antidepressants that P-glycoprotein does not touch. They are bupropion, Wellbutrin, duloxetine, Cymbalta, fluoxetine, Prozac, and mirtazapine, Remeron. You kind of got one from each of the new classes there. Testing for P-glycoprotein variations is not likely to be very informative for these meds, and they may be worth trying in treatment-resistant cases as an alternative to raising the dose of a P-glycoprotein metabolized med. And now for the word of the day, schizo-obsessive disorder.
Obsessive-compulsive symptoms are very common in schizophrenia. We see them on some level in 25% of patients with schizophrenia. Usually they show up when the patient is not in a full psychotic episode. The word for this overlap is schizo-obsessive disorder, or schizo-OCD. And next week, we'll interview Michael Poyarovsky on this complex comorbidity.
You can earn CME credits online and use the promo code PODCAST if you do to get $30 off your first year subscription. That helps us stay in the ranks of Cook's Illustrated, Ms. Magazine, Arizona Highways, and the select group of publications that do not accept commercial support.